dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Well, greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, dynamic voices for a diverse church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I am your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at BurnsClan. Follow at your own risk. And joining me, as always, is the founder of The Witness, the man, the myth, the legend, the two-time best-selling author, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Jamar Tisby. What's going on, brother?
So I see I'm still the only audio-first guy on this call because I got the big headphones, studio headphones. Everybody else, everybody, you know, looking good. You know, I'm just saying.
On the rule of podcast, everybody can't see you, brother.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Look, that's all right. That's all right. I can hear y'all great, and I'm super excited about the show today.
Yes.
Oh, let's get to
that's it. That's a double entendre.
Look,
the MC showing up.
I got bars.
I didn't even catch it. Jamar's a boxer, a rapper. I don't know what's going on. What else? What else is going to be discovered about him? But of course, the voice that you hear, the third voice, is the writer, artist, filmmaker, philanthropist,
creative,
artisan, creative, Black man, husband, father, gift to the body of Christ.
I'll take them all.
Mr. Show Baraka. Show, what's going on, brother?
I'm doing great. I do all of them at a very incompetent level, but I'll take it.
No.
Okay, I'm just playing.
We're not doing that.
Hold up. Did I hear Jamar has hands? Jamar, you got hands, bro?
You know, man? Back in the day in college,
I engaged in
the sweet science. I was a welterweight champ in my class. Yeah.
What? All right, hold up.
Fight racism.
Let's go. I would have never thought this. What do I need to do to get you and KB in the ring?
This is not the first time this has been missed.
I'll commentate.
KB lose about 50 pounds and then, we could go toe to toe.
You're going to be a Tank Davis in there, Jamar. You're going to be a Tank Davis.
Well, listen, I just need a trainer. Show you can, if you can train me, I might get in the ring for it.
I don't know what street fight. You'd be able to swing.
We could do some exhibition fights. Like who's that dude? The young European descended brother who's a YouTube star. You know what I'm saying?
The Pauls.
Yeah.
The Paul brothers got on past the mic. We got to shut the show down.
It's just got to be that exhibition. You know, I'll walk away with 100 million. If that's cool, that's fine.
Oh, absolutely hilarious. Tisby got hands.
Okay.
Tisby got hands. I'm telling you. Well, we are here to talk
piece,
this
two
show.
Don't give Tyler any more ammo. Don't give him no more. You heard that introduction.
Two piece Tisby.
Listen, we got the next one. The most important insights we have are coming from show. Oh, my gosh.
Listen. Man, we got to talk about the book. He saw that it was good. It's a new book by Show Baraka.
What a title. Creativity what a works. Title.
It's absolutely phenomenal.
Look at the artwork.
So if you're on the podcast and you're listening, you got to get on Patreon to get the video. So this is just a free plug for Patreon. Pay $1 episode. You can get the video.
The visuals.
See all the fancy artwork, everything.
Yeah.
But show, you are writing a book about creativity, work, all these other topics intersecting with faith and your Blackness and your humanity.
Yeah.
Why now? Why that book now? Everything is swirling. And to talk about creativity, creation, work, it seems like it's countercultural to the moment itself. So tell us why this book was necessary for you.
Yeah, so it's interesting, Jamar, you know, and even you, Tyler, you know, congratulations on contributing to, you know, Lecrae's work. You know that you don't write books in months. Books take a year at the, you know, I mean, if you got that kind of pull, you can get a published work in some months, but very rarely. So this has been a process since 2018. I think I signed. No, 2018 is when I started the process. 2019 is when I agreed to with the publisher. And then in 2020, the world turned upside down. And so my challenge was, will this book be relevant when it releases. You know, is this going to be appropriate for the cultural moment? And I just had to trust that the Lord gave me a prophetic voice in the sense that the things that I wanted to talk about would be relevant. And here's what I was struggling with, because I didn't want this book to be a book about creativity. I knew that because, one, I wanted to reach more than just creative. And so I wanted to posture this book in the way that it spoke to people who contribute to, one, building narratives, people who work, which should be everybody, are people who saw themselves in some sort of facet of creating in general. And so, and I was like, man, if people have a better theology of work, if people have a better theology of story, then maybe we wouldn't be in these predicaments that we're in right now. And so that's the reason why I think this book was necessary. That's the reason why I think it still has its place in today, even though from the title and from maybe even from the cover and even from the pitch, it doesn't feel like it's a book on justice. It may not feel like it's a book on race. It may not feel like it's a book on politics, but it's all of those things just from the from the standpoint of how we produce and how we create.
That's super helpful.
So I have so many questions because your angles in this book are creative, right? So one of the things I want to talk about just globally, just sort of from a broad standpoint, the importance of story, the importance of narrative. Why that thing that gripped you and why you think that's so important? And I really do think, even though the process started a couple of years ago, super relevant right now. Talk about story.
Man, I have this belief that storytelling is identity formation. Like, we all are shaped by a story. And so, bro, when I was listening to Pac back in the day, or, you know, I grew up in Southern California, Snoop Dogg was telling me to smoke a certain type of weed. And I was like, this is the kind of weed we smoking, y'all, because Tupac said it.
right.
You know, if the culture told me to wear these types of clothes, that's what I wore. As a mature man, we listen to, you know, we still listen to hip hop in some ways, but now you get your stories told through politics or through literature, you know, academia. They're all shaping, they're all telling stories that form who we are and what we think. And these stories are transmitted through culture, through media, through friendships, family, or whatever. And I have a story about my mother telling me that I look good in red in chapter one. And to this day, red is my favorite color, right? You know what I'm saying? And that indelible impact she had on me was life affirming. She said, baby, you look good in this color. And I was like, well, that's all I need to hear to feel myself. I'm like, come on. Like, you telling me that red is, look, I am going out in these streets wearing red, bro. Like I said, I grew up in Southern California. And so that's not a smart thing to wear red in certain parts of the
country. That was not a neutral statement.
Right. But some of us will die for the things that are affirming to us. Right. And I also grew up in a household that my mom told me to read the Harlem Renaissance, to read Malcolm X's autobiography. And so at a young age, I knew that the person who I was greater than whatever circumstance I was in Southern California and in an empire. Like, I knew that the legacy of Claude McKay and the legacy of Zora Neale Hurston and all these people spoke to me because, like, I time traveled with them when I read their literature, when I read their work. And so that formed who I am today. That's the reason why I love the things I love. I mean, it transitioned me to love hip hop. Only reason why I'm not a poet today is because hip hop seemed to get more girls than poetry. And so I was like, all right, let me stop doing this poetry and rap. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, yeah.
I love that.
And guess what? Stories called January 6th to happen. You know what I'm saying? Somebody got on a podium, told some stories.
Say that.
Stories happened before then, but you know, there's stories that formulate things that create ideas and movements, and therefore people act out of those stories. And so, if we tell better stories, we'll see better society. I think.
Can I?
Yeah, that's yeah. Go ahead, Jay.
I just want to riff off of that for a second. And part of this is selfish because my new role is with narrative and advocacy, right? And so, one of the questions we're sort of constantly talking about, particularly in terms of anti-racism, is how you use stories to reshape and change bad narratives, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the insurrection, and it's really actually packaged as a narrative because they call it, quote, the big lie, right? Mm. And that can be deployed actually in both directions. But another example, sort of case study, is critical race theory. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole per se, but how do we deploy story in the face of misinformation?
So I think there's a couple ways you can do it. I mean, I think, and I'll speak authoritatively from a creative and an artist, because I feel like that's where I'm most capable of doing. So I think you can do it. You tell better stories through anecdotes in the political space. You could tell better stories as anecdotes in the academic space and, you know, social space, which is helpful. But for me, in the creative space, I think you tell better stories that sometimes you fight fiction with fiction, if you will, right? So I think about, you know, some of the great luminaries that I appreciate, everybody from, you know, the Toni Morrisons to, you know, the Zora Neales and the great literature writers of our day. And their fiction disarms people about a truth that they may have held tightly to. And it gets them to imagine a world, a democracy, politics, race in a way that maybe they didn't before. Music does the same thing. I mean, I wish I can think of a song, but you think about people who will engage a musical product more than they'll engage somebody saying the same things, but on a podium. Right. And so I write music now in order to create conversations, to invite people to this place, to create this hospitable space for people to talk to one another, better yet. And so art does a beautiful thing of disarming. Story does a beautiful thing of disarming. And so for me, when I think about like in sports, there was this, you know, our coach would just say, if you want people to stop dancing in the end zone, stop them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, well, if we want people, Toni Morrison makes the statement, if, you know, write the stories that you want to read. And for me, if I want to stop terrible stories, well, then write better stories. Turn people's attention away from those stories. Snatch the attention of the folks who are hearing these ridiculous, vile stories, and give them stories that, you know, creatively expand their imagination. And, especially Flannery O'Connor was a person who did this exceptionally well, especially as a white woman in the South who had the trust of the Southerner, the white Southerner, and talked about their racism, poked at their racism, and told stories that showed them a mirror of themselves. And I think we need to employ art in a way that tells honest stories, not only about the, I guess you say our opposition, but us as well.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really love about that element specifically within the book is that this book is not safe. And it's clear even from the language choices that you allowed to be put in there. And I saw you post some things about people saying, oh, I was listening to this in my car and my kids were in here. And then it said this. It was like quoting the rap lyrics. I was like, oh. But I love that because
they're going to take him off the shelves at Lifeway. Wait a minute.
Oh, they don't exist no more.
Deep cut. I think it was so good to hear kind of a fuller perspective of your heart and your mind on life. And I just want to hold space for that because I think you've been through a lot over the past decade. And we're going to get into that because we followed you for a while. We've had you on the show before, but it's been years.
Yeah.
And watching your journey with art and with faith and also being ostracized and pushed out. And then now the culture has kind of moved towards that. Yeah. And so it's just like all these things that are, what did it feel like to really share your journey and share those parts of yourself as you were navigating this? Because I know it had to have been personal for you to write some of this stuff down because it's what you went through.
I think the most difficult part was censoring myself, if anything, or knowing that I needed to censor myself because some relationships still aren't fully repaired. Some people that I could have said more about, I didn't. And I wanted to honor, I thought, you know, this, I didn't want this to be a memoir, like a tell-all book. I wanted this to be I wanted this to be a catalyst for people who are like me, but maybe younger. And they're like, man, for some reason, these evangelical spaces are just, they're restricting me. Like, I don't know what to do. young man, here's this book. Like, listen to the story, and here's how I navigated it. Hopefully this will be beneficial for you. Let me put you on game, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't difficult for me to necessarily share my story. It was more difficult for me to, like, if you read this book, you can probably tell, like, it's more of like a collection of essays than it is as one consistent thought. And I knew there were things I wanted to talk about. And in chapter 5, I really wanted to talk about what does it mean to either exist in the evangelical space or leave an evangelical space. And for me, I was like, bro, like, here's some tools and some principles that I've used. And hopefully for those folks that are in these spaces, if we're going to leave, what can we build? Like, bro, like, what can we build? It's funny. I'm going to divert a little bit. I was having a conversation with Lecrae this past week, and your name came up, Tyler, because he said that you said the same thing to him. I told Lecrae, I was like, look, bro, I look, with all your alts that you have with Christian hip hop and et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that we need to do is we need to build land. We need land and we need legacy. Like, I talk about this in my book, but the land and the legacy can't be built without you. Like, we need a Lecrae to take ownership of this particular entity, this cultural product that these Black folks have been building and white people own. You know what I'm saying? And until Black people start owning this cultural product, bro, we're going to continue 50 years from now. We're going to be like, yo, our kids are going to be like, yo, what did y'all leave us? And we're like, well, we got these ideas. we got these ideas we got for you. And that's kind of my tension between the Booker T and the Du Bois. It's like, why do we have to be either or? Like, Du Bois has some great ideas and Booker T actually had brick and mortar. If we put that together, bro, it'll be a beast of a combination. And I praise God for entities, even like yourselves, and, you know, and like, how can these different institutions begin to figure out, rather than being competitive with one another, you know, how do we build institutions that can leave a legacy? Because the one thing that we can't do as Black evangelicals, if you call yourself that, but Black Christians, is we do not have enough resource and manpower for 5 people to be doing the same thing. We just can't do it.
Preach on it. Yeah.
We need 1 or 2 good institutions that do that thing. And then we need to support that thing. And then let's move over to the next. Like, hey, who's doing the music thing? Y'all do. All right. We go. Who's doing the conference thing? Okay. Who's doing the educational? Okay. And rather than everybody creating 18 different church plant organizations, 18 different, you know, media platforms, 18 different.
Right.
It's like, look, bro, we're killing ourselves. And so for me, I just wanted to give this what I think is a game plan of how you can save your life before it gets to a point of extreme confusion and chaos.
So let's go there, show, because I think it's important. The 3 of us are on this. Let's talk about
Tyler,
this.
Tyler's getting ready. He's rubbing his hands.
No, I just let's talk about this, because organizationally, Black Christian organizations, can you talk about some of the challenges of collaboration? It's an open conversation. Okay.
No, yeah. Here.
Open conversation.
Really real. 100. I think, you know, so there's a couple of things I think. One, there's always the greatest problem is always this idea of doctrine and philosophy and, like, do you align with fill in the blank?
Yes.
And so I think in some ways, yeah, like, you know, that's important. You know, I don't want people to forfeit the fidelity of the scriptures and et cetera. But there are some things that we have to just let loose of. Like, I'm going to be completely candid with you. I'm not the biggest supporter of, like, the biggest proponent, better yet, of Black Lives Matter, the institution. But if they came to me and asked me to partner with them in some way, I would do it. Because I'm like, all right, yeah. At the end of the day, there's an interest towards justice and liberation that I think we share and we could be co-belligerent in. Boom. Now, are there going to be dissenting? Of course, obviously. They're going to look at me and they're going to be like, X, Y, and Z. I'm going to look at them, X, Y, and Z. But if there's a way that we can collaborate, great. So when I look at, even within the Christian space, we have too much of that, even with people who have similar views. And I'm like, I don't understand. The other thing is, I think we have such a deficiency in an opportunity that a lot of us are there's a lot of us who've experienced the deficiency in platform and resources that when we get it, we feel like we got to hoard it. Hmm. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we steward it well. I put steward in quotation marks, which means it's just you. And so it's hard for. And then there's just the theological or the philosophical disagreement on, well, this person is attached or has this attachment to this particular group of people or institution, and these people have this attachment to this particular individual or people. I mean, very similar to all of history, Black history, from Delaney to and Douglas to, you know, Claude McKay and Garvey and Booker T and Du Bois. It's like, why can't these folks collaborate? I don't understand. We could be so much further if people decided to collaborate. It makes no sense. Amongst the talent on this call, the talent in the folks that have so many different platforms, I'm like, bro, we could create a revolution in the Black evangelical, Black Christian space. But for some reason, there's this unspoken, I don't know what you call it, that exists. And Jamar and I texted about a couple months ago. There was something that I tweeted and I wanted him to know. It's like, look, man, I want to be perfectly honest and transparent with you. Like, I did think of you a little bit when I text this out. However, this doesn't mean that I don't love you and I don't respect you and fill in the blank. And I think there's too much subtweeting. There's too much communication that and people aren't being honest and transparent with one another and getting through the messiness of some of our philosophical differences. So it's some of those three areas, and I'm sure there's other ones that I can't think of, but those three, I think, are the most prominent issues that I think we have to figure out how to get over, because it feels good. And I hate to call people tokens because or Toms. I don't sure, think that's yeah, fair. Yeah. I don't think that's fair, but it does feel good to feel wanted. I experienced that for many years. It feels good to feel desired, to feel loved over, and to be the man or the, you know, the woman in a particular institution. And when you feel that way and somebody's talking about collaborating and you're there's a potential that you won't be that anymore, it's difficult. It's a difficult thing to let go of. So I don't know. What are y'all thoughts? What are some of your things that you guys think?
So thank you for being honest. I think that's extremely helpful. I'm going to let Jamar hop in here in a second. I think, you know, what I would say, we do a good and bad job of, this is a positive and a negative, is we collaborate in crisis. Mm. And it always takes a tragedy or a danger or an outside force or overt racist attacking us for us to come together. And it's so interesting because I think about this, even the people who I'm not necessarily, you know, we're honest. But even the people who I'm not necessarily like, oh, man, I'm, you know, rocking with them, everything they say on Twitter. If a racist attacks them, it's like, oh, they attacked all of us. Or if someone publishes something slanderous, oh, they attacked all of us. But yeah, then it's so easy for us to retreat back to that corner.
Yeah,
and I also want to be honest about the fact that Jamar and I are working through what it looks like for this to be a reality. And there's some people behind the scenes that have really helped us. But you know, I think there is a level to which Black people, and I'll be specific, Black men, mm-hmm. it's very hard for us to navigate who leads who.
Absolutely.
And it's very hard for us to navigate how leadership is dispersed and shared, mm-hmm. and the implicit feeling that if we step into a space with people who are not jot and tittle in line with everything that we think or believe, mm-hmm. that we'll lose part of ourselves. And that's always the greatest fear, I think, implicitly with a lot of Black Christians who are pursuing justice and pushing these movements, that we're going to lose part of ourselves because we lost so much of ourselves when we were immersed in white spaces, when we were immersed in whatever it may be. And so I think those are two that we're still working through, man. I'm glad you went there, because I was wondering if you're going to go there. I'm glad you went there, because I think we're still navigating it, because I hate the being in Black church for so many years and working in Black organizations, I just hate the stigma that we can't work together.
Yeah.
I just hate the stigma that we can't navigate this together, or that there's not something that we can collaborate on, even if we do disagree and wrestle with one another and struggle. I just cannot stand that idea. And I think it hurts our people more than it does our reputation with white people.
Facts. So
it's not like what it peers in, you know, what people say about us peering in. I'm talking about it hurts our community.
Absolutely. You know?
And so, anyway, Jamar, hop in.
Ooh, this is such an important conversation. I don't have a unifying thought, but I have a smattering of thoughts, right?
For all of the places.
One of the issues. Well, one of the issues, I stumbled into institution building, right? With what started out as a Reformed African American Network and then what became The Witness. I didn't have some sort of master plan or overarching philosophy. I was just like, we can't get it done in these white spaces. We got to do something for us, by us, kind of a thing. And it is so much work to be Black, let alone Black and Christian, and build something. Like, that takes 80% of your energy. and anything that's left is rare and valuable as far as additional energy, thought, creativity that we have, right? So I think part of it is we're all in our respective organizations sort of stuck in survival mode. And the paradox of that is, well, maybe we wouldn't be stuck in survivor mode if we worked together more, right? So then the other aspect, though, is philosophy of change. So if you look back historically at movements and all those sort of dichotomies that you listed show between the different individuals and personalities, where they couldn't get on the same page was an approach to change. How does change happen and how does it happen effectively? And then when there was a disagreement, that was sort of end of it, right? Related to that and related to the survival mode aspect is, when do we have time to really think about and collaborate on these things, right? Part of it's even just logistical. I can't tell you, I mean, for my entire career in these sort of Black Christian, Black evangelical spaces, we've been talking about gatherings. We've been talking about strategic get-togethers of, you know, particular voices in particular spaces that when we come together, we can Voltron up and no matter what comes of it concretely, we can at least communicate and theologize and philosophize, right? I think it's happened bits and pieces here and there. But I wonder if that gathering has really ever come together in literally in the 21st century, in the past 20 years, right? And that's important because that gives us chronological and mental space to explore some of this stuff, also to build relationships. The last thing I'll say is it's hard to talk about this stuff in the abstract. So Tyler, when you mentioned like we come together in crisis, that's because a crisis presents us with a specific situation in which to intervene.
Sure.
Somebody said something, somebody wrote something, somebody got killed. So the question then is, you know, I bet you we're probably broadly on the same page as far as aims, right? We want voting rights. We want transformation in public safety so that getting pulled over doesn't cause an anxiety attack. Right. Mm-hmm. But is there one thing or an initiative or an issue that we can actually name and get together on? And I think that would actually be easier because, like you were saying, show, you know, if BLM approached you with something, oh, we got this march or we got this, you know, social media campaign, that's a specific ask that we can evaluate. So that's what I'm.
Yeah. No, I think it's. Yeah.
That's helpful.
This could be a conversation for this can be a the one thing that I will say is I am, and this is the romantic in me, which is funny because I'm not a romantic. I'm almost a pessimist to my detriment. I am thinking greater than just it's like a campaign. I am thinking greater than just a issue. Yes, voting rights. If that was the thing, I'm pretty sure we can easily get 15 Black institutions or leaders around a voters' right campaign. I'm thinking about legacy. Oh, I am saying, like, is there a way to get collective synergy, a collective movement behind these prominent institutions and movements within in Black Christian spaces that are doing work in similar places, so that the folks who support the AND campaign could also jump on Pass the Mic. Like, so it's not just the AND campaign has its crowd. Pass the Mic has its crowd. I forget the name, but like the National Baptist Convention, the Black National Convention has its group, and Vince Bantu is trying to start a seminary. Like, I'm saying, like, there are too many of these great thinkers and movements that have a following, that have great ideas, that are operating almost in silos. And to Tyler's point, the only time we can create some synergy is in crisis. But when there is feast, how do we use the resources of that feast and this white institutional money? If you're for that, because I'm all the way protecting these folks' money and using it for the good. Like, how do we use when these folks are contrite and they want to see some repair and say, hey, let's put it towards some sort of grand institutional building or some sort of infrastructure that pushes people towards some unified movements. And I am not smart enough to create that. I'm smart enough to dream it and say, Jamar, Tyler, figure this thing out, but we need it. I use my influence to bring some of these jokers. Look, I'll call it Lecrae. Come through. Like, through. Like, we need you, bro. Rebuke it. Yo, you are a Christian hip hop artist. Be a Christian hip hop artist and support these movements. And then you over here, like, we just need people to come together and figure out how to create this black coalition of folks who want to do justice. There's too many of us that are, and I don't know if it's wishful thinking, because it may be, because either way, I still want to see people succeed, no matter, if I'm a part or attached to the movement or not. I want to see people succeed, but I think they will succeed better. And here's the other thing. I mean, if we're be real, we got to appeal to people's self-interest, because the reality is, and how do you do that? How do you appeal to people's self-interest, right? Well, come on, let's check this out, bro. When's your next book coming out? Like, all right, shoot, we're going to figure out how to make that thing even bigger than the last book. You know what I'm saying? Now that we have this greater collective, you know what I'm saying? Get Charlie Dates and all his buddies and, like, hey, do a church tour, through these. So it's just thinking like that. Like, how do we get people? But I think we're all communicating the obstacles that we know that are before us. But I don't think they're big enough to cripple us from being dangerous, not only for the kingdom of God, but for those folks who have been on the margins.
Yeah. And let me say, I think this is an extremely important conversation. And I actually think we need to have a follow-up conversation with you about this with, some of our friends, Lisa Fields, Allie on our team, Truth Table, some of our sisters as well, because I think there's so many different perspectives that I feel like they'll bring to this conversation. And there's also some of this is just like black male dynamics as well.
Absolutely.
We're trying to navigate this together. And so many of our leaders in the past, have been black women who just said, we got to get this done. So y'all can work this out later, but we're going to get this done.
I think what you're doing there, I didn't name enough women. My bad.
No. The reason I was thinking this was I was recently at this gathering with Vince and Lisa. And we were strategizing, talking about certain things. And I remember thinking, I've never spent time in the room with them where it wasn't like an event. Or it wasn't like some we were passing by or, hey, how's it going? And when I got, when I saw Lisa, what she was doing, when I saw Vince, I was like, okay, this is really interesting how these two, perspectives intersect with ours. And then, there are differences and then there are different goals and aims. And it was just, so it just made me think of that gathering. That's why I said Lisa, because it just made me think like, oh yeah.
Absolutely.
Like the perspective and the influence of black women is just so central to this conversation. Man, okay, no, so we need to continue this. We need to continue this. But yeah. I did tell you I wanted to talk about your perspective on Christian hip hop. And your navigation of your Reach Records exit, your expansion beyond just that little silo in Christian hip hop to really making broad music and making groundbreaking music as well. Like if you think about Jim Crow as a song, I remember, like, people don't people do not understand. It was a moment. Like when that Twitter wasn't as big as it was now, but it felt like that dominated Black Christian Twitter. Like everyone's talking about Jim Crow, especially in the Christian hip hop space. Everybody was saying, well, he shouldn't say this. He should say this. He shouldn't say this. And then even the broader conversation about how art was dealt with and the influence of what you even talk about in the book is it felt like y'all were being recruited as culture warriors. Be treated like Puritan. You had to evaluate things like Puritan pastors. Talk about that journey out and some of the things that you've learned on the way out and are still learning about that time.
It's good. I'm glad you said still learning, because I do think there's a ton, there are times, even me, when I talk about this, I feel like I've arrived in some ways, and I don't want to come off as arrogant and to be really serious though, I appreciate you mentioning Truth's Table and Lisa Fields, because I think it's good. Like, because I can get in this mode where I just talk about leaders and institution, and then you name men, you know what I'm saying? And you have to be very vigilant and understanding the obstacles that, you know, that we sometimes create. And that is the marginalizing of women leaders and their voices. And so I think stuff like that is the things that we have to be contented in. It's like, yo, we are still learning. I am still, even though I feel like I'm a great advocate, it's very important to be an advocate in moments like this as well. So for me, man, like I've talked about this recently, but people, you know, don't know, like the kind of household I grew up in, it was, my mom was a Black Panther, outside Los Angeles, grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up outside Los Angeles. And so my whole life, like I grew up Rodney King beatings, race riots, OJ trial. That was my LAPD, I'll graduate high school, go to Tuskegee University, not because I had to, I wanted to. I am in the West Coast, ain't no Black colleges nowhere near west of Texas. So it's like, I wanted to go to a HBCU. And so for me, you know, with the Hillman College, what is that? The TV show, where am I?
Yeah, Cosby Show.
Nah, not Cosby Show, the spinoff with Lisa Bonet and...
Oh, Different World?
Different World. Different World and School Days were like my my introduction into this desire to want to go to a Black college. And so I do that. I become a Christian many years later. And then I get introduced into this, you know, this white evangelical world. And I'm like, oh, so all the things that made me who I am, I got to forfeit that. Like, I gotta give that up. You know what I'm saying? And I got to start reading, you know, these Puritan pastors. And as much as I'm going to mock my experience there, yes, I did learn some great things from the John Edwards and the Luthers and the Pipers. And like, granted, there was truth that they gave. However, there's no good. It's not beneficial when you're getting insight, but you feel like you have to demoralize the very thing that made you who you are. Right. And so for me, there was this moment in 2011, 2012, when I knew I was kind of like leaving Reach Records. I knew it was pretty much the end of my rope, because we had been sitting with all these great prominent pastors. We had had funding by these organizations. And I just felt like at the end of the day, Omar Grant was shot by police officers in 2010. And I just knew that I couldn't just keep making the same kind of music that I made and ignore the Oscar Grants. And then Rakia Boyd was shot in Chicago. And I'm sitting here thinking like, does anybody, like, are we going to talk about this? Is anybody going to mention this? Like, I grew up in California. I've seen police brutality. My uncle was literally choked out by police officers in early 90s when when Arizona was debating on whether or not they were going to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. And so that's my experience. Like, I couldn't avoid this stuff. These conversations were ever present on me. And I'm sitting there thinking like, oh, but they're cool when I talk about gang violence. They're cool when I talk about the pathologies of the Black community. Right? Yeah. But I can't talk about the things that created those pathologies, if you will. And so I was just like, I just can't do this anymore, bro. I was just like, I got to figure out how to do something different. And I had a meeting with a brother, And he was just like, Joe, you need to stop reading these theologians and get back to reading the people that led you to Tuskegee. And that's what I did. And I started to read more of the sociologists of the past, the poets and the prophetic voices of the brothers and sisters who came before us. And that made me think like, oh, I just can't make music the same way that I made it before. And so at that point, I knew I couldn't do this. And, you know, this is not slander because I've had this conversation with Reach Records and those relationships are healed and amended. And there's a documentary that they're actually doing. So I talk about this as well. But I don't know if I was supposed to say that. I don't know if I was supposed to say that at all.
Yes.
Anyway. but anyway, the point is that I felt like at that moment, we were mercenaries for a culture war. We were rewarded for calling out things that benefited, you know, these evangelicals because it gave them credibility that these black men were speaking to issues that that I guess you can say accelerated their reason for missions and charity in particular communities without dealing with the systems that created them. And this is the reason why we need to support these things. This is the reason why we need these church plants. Or this is the reason why we need that. And I'm like, yeah, granted, we need there needs to be charitable work. There needs to be churches, but not done in that with those pretenses. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Not done from those postures. And so that was my reason for Talent at 10th, which also included the song Jim Crow, which you talked about, which as you listen to those songs now, which were, I guess, revolutionary at the time. Now, today, it's like, oh, that's nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, that's what he's talking about? Oh, yeah. Well, at least I don't know. Maybe
he's still revolutionary. No, I mean, I think there are elements in the way you're having a conversation. Still in the Christian space, I think. We still have these hesitations
about what
we talk about and like the nuance of how we talk about it. And so I think that album and the narrative were very bold in how they kind of dealt with and approached those topics.
Yeah.
And I feel like we need collective healing from that period.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like we all need, I don't know if it's a conversation, a moment, a lament, you know, whatever, but I feel like we lost a lot and I feel like we just moved past that. And it seemed to pass very quickly because it was at its height and then extended for a while and then just moved very quickly off of everyone's radar and everyone's mind. I think it's generational too. I think, you know, some of us got a little bit older. We got into certain things, but man, I think there's a lot of pain there.
Oh, I think you're spitting wisdom. I think what you're saying is so wise because what I've seen is the way that people are, I don't want to demoralize how people are healing, but the way that people are dealing with it is they're totally abandoning the church. Like and I'm not talking about just people who were consumers of like the products that people were giving out those times from the Rands to the Reaches to the church planning network. I'm just saying like the leaders, there are leaders who were part of those, who are the ones who were created, who are now just like, I'm done. And I think that's sad. I think that's disheartening because to me, and this could be controversial, I feel like that empowers whiteness and white supremacy even more to allow those folks to allow that to manipulate all of how you view the Christian faith. And the usefulness of the church to me empowers white supremacy more than I think it is.
Yeah, we've had to delineate early in 2021 on Pass the Mic. We had the Leave Loud series and people thought what we meant was leaving Christianity. We're like, no, we're talking about leaving white supremacist slaveholder Christianity. We're talking about returning to, or perhaps discovering for the first time, the Christianity of Christ. Right. Yeah. So I think you're right about that. And to your point, Tyler, about healing, one of the things that I'm still trying to heal from, there was this phrase, Colin Hanson wrote the book, Young, Restless, and Reformed. there was a black element of that. Young, restless, black, and reformed, maybe, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we need healing from that, right? Like, I think many of us who, quite honestly, if at least if I'm speaking to myself, were discipled by what one could call Christian hip hop, which, to the credit of many of the leaders, including you, Sho, also walked us through the process of extricating ourselves through that, right?
Yes.
That's part of what Talented 10th was. That's part of what Anomaly was, Lecrae's mm-hmm. album for me. A lot of that. Anyway, so, but I don't know that we ever had closure, or at least a reckoning. You know what I'm saying? That we ever really paused to take stock of how we got into it, what it did to us, and where we're going now. So
that sounds like a Pastor Mike conference or something. Our witness conference.
We actually talked about that. We have been kind of talking about that behind the scenes. I think it needs to be something broader, because I think, number one, there needs to be a lot of honor given to y'all for walking through this in public. Huh. And it's why I think it's so good that we're having this conversation now. I feel like there wasn't the appropriate honor for the people who really laid the track and the groundwork for where many of us are today, because it is all adjacent and connected. And so I think there needs to be an honor element there. I also think there just does need to be a space for y'all to share what you have done so in books and other forums, but what was really happening and what's really happening now in light of that? Cause I sense we talked about this a few weeks ago in this, you know, kind of theme of in the wilderness, that when you look back at where you were, you feel this sense of shame, and many of us, that's all we knew. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I think it's something we need to repent of. And yes, I think it's something we need to say, I those comments about black church, black spaces, I was wilding out. I was believing this and thinking that, you know what I'm saying? But I feel like we beat ourselves up, and I feel like there's not like a level of healing that can take place in y'all.
Because the fans
and the audience members that propped it up, we haven't given you that space, really. I mean, we just kind of hopped in and out, depending on what you do when you do it.
Right,
he's tripping, and then when he came around, like, go Sho. And he's like, well, I'm hurting. You know what I'm saying?
And no, absolutely.
Like, up and down, you know.
I don't know. Look, if I'm honest, I don't. You know, I don't know if I've completely healed. I feel like I have. You know, that could be the machismo in me that's like, I'm a man. I ain't a punk. You know, I don't know. I really think that I was wounded for a good. So 2012 is when I wrote the narrative. I released it January 1st, 2013. It got so dark for me in 2013, 2014 that I literally was looking for like any job. I went out, you know, people who lay, and I'm not demeaning the work that they do, but you know, the people who work on freeways and they lay down the strips on the grounds. Like, I went out, I was like, look, I need a job. I need to work, because right now, these concerts ain't coming. People don't want me to speak. They don't want me to do anything. And that was because I bit the hand that fed me. And the Lord just opened up a door for me to do some other work, in which I didn't have to do, you know, I didn't have to do that. But it was crazy how I was at the most, I was so humbled and in such a dark place that I was like, yeah, nobody loves me, man. Like, and then Michael Brown is shot. And it's crazy. Because then after that, then people are like, oh, Sho, you was making sense. And then all of a sudden, all these speaking engagements start coming up. All these, you know, hey, tell us about teaching. Like, and I was like, oh, this is crazy. Like, you know what I'm saying? And I think over the period of time, it also taught me how to be more compassionate as well. Like, because I was really angry. Like, somebody showed me a tweet of like anybody from Reach Records, I'd be like, man, F them. You know what I'm saying? Because I was I felt like they left me out in the cold. I felt like they didn't support me and blah, 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 blah. And but it also showed me, it's like, Sho, do you give roses to people who came before you? Are you loving and supporting and giving opportunity to folks that need to be, you know, propagated and supported as well? And it made me realize, like, all right, I don't want to ever be the thing that I hate. And so it taught me how to be humble. And I think I've healed from that. Yes. So to this day, I feel like, yo, man, I just want to see. I want to see brothers and sisters come to a place where we are. We keep our eyes on the system. We call out white supremacy and institutional racism, wherever it is, but that we build something. Like, I just want to see vision. I want us to construct something so that when my daughter is in her 30s, or when my grandkids or whatever, if I ever have it, like, that they would be able to say, oh, this is where I go when I'm feeling like isolated. Like, this is the publication that I can trust when I want to hear somebody talk about the, you know, the faith, and also it's not bifurcated from my identity as a Black woman or a man. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, if I'm looking for a church, where's the website that I can trust that's going to lead me? Oh, Jew 3 has, okay. Like, where's the musical identity that I can chase after that's in the legacy of the Renaissance and the civil rights movement? Like, oh, it's these particular people. And right now we're so disintegrated that I feel that, and I think some of that disintegration is the byproduct of our own inner self-loathing, maybe. But a lot of that is intentional. Like, we want to be the woman, or we want to be the man. And I think it just takes a lot of humility. And so for me, yeah, I've helped start some institutions, but I'm also willing to shout out and be a part of what other institutions that I feel are going to do the work of the ministry that's not going to marginalize people. And so hopefully, I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, I exited. And I feel like, if anything, I exited really well with particular institutions, because I felt like I could have been more ridiculous. And I'm glad I wasn't, because I think I wasn't mature enough to handle being loud, as you guys say, like leaving loud. Like, I would have left loud. And even though I did feel like I left loud, but I would have left loud in a more hood, ridiculous way. And like, look, y'all gonna hear me, you know. But I will say that the beautiful thing about leaving is when I see my brothers and sisters who have left as well, I want to be able to redeem and reconcile the time that we lost. Mm. And I feel like that's starting to happen with some of us. And I want to be able to rejoice. But as you said, Tyler, what I think is brilliant is, how do we lament and just lament together? And so, yeah, hopefully that was cogent. I don't know, sometimes I'll just be rambling.
Nah, that's super helpful. Super helpful.
As we sort of round out the conversation, we've been talking a lot about institution building and leaving a legacy, and that's so critical and so important. One thing I'm curious about is, in your view, show, where is the church in this? What is the church's role as both an organism and an institution, as really the oldest, you know, Black institution that we have? How do we not overlook the church as part of our legacy, and also learn from, you know, the fact that it's filled with sinners, and it's also not such a capacious institution that is going to encompass everything necessary.
This is where I'll revert to answering as a creative and not necessarily a theologian and pastor, because I have much experience in playing those roles. I will say, man, I think the one thing that the church needs to do is figure out how to patronize better, like support its the people, like the way that they send out missionaries. how do we figure out to send off entrepreneurs and send off artists and send off politicians? You know what I'm saying? Because white evangelicals are doing it. And I even think that the Black church does it well in the political space. The Black church often has real close connections to its local political leaders. Traditional church, shall I say, the Black traditional church. But I think, you know, this movement of folks who are kind of like the young reformed and restless, that Black neo-black reformed folks who came out of all the different tenets of kind of Protestantism that was in this Christian hip hop community. I feel like the folks who planted churches who are now be leaders in churches that are in their 50s, with like 30s and 40s, and now have some sort of institutional power. They got to figure out how to empower those folks that are entrepreneurs and artists. Because at the end of the day, this is all spiritual, obviously, but the spiritual, like that spiritual connection has economic repercussions. It has social repercussions. And the church has always been an institution in Black community, better yet, that has been closely tied to the, I guess you can say, like the social location of its people. So it's always been tethered to, all right, well, how do we support folks financially? How do we support politically? And I think too often what we've done is tried to create these movements devoid of the church. I think, man, if anything, we have to use the church, because we know like these are what people galvanize. People trust the institution, no matter what, how crazy folks get in the church. People are gonna always go to a church. They're gonna always go. Folks disappear, but they're gonna come back. And so, but church leaders have to get to a place where they don't see the church as their own institution to guide with for their own personal agenda. And, you know, when I have conversations with pastors and they ask me, you know, how can we support artists? That's what I tell them. I said, man, how are you supporting them financially? How are you giving them spaces to flourish and thrive? And are you not just giving them, like just the plot of land on Sunday morning to just sing songs or rap, but are you giving them more opportunity? Are you giving them more space and more leverage? And are we allowing them to exist outside of the Christian culture paradigm? Because that's another thing. Yeah, I think about Toby, right? It's obvious Toby is Toby. I don't know how to say his last name, but anyway, is a that's where, you know, the my name is Amisho Baraka, but my tongue is very Western, and so there's like, you know, Toby couldn't make it in Christian hip hop music. Like I am so happy that he did not go the Christian hip hop route, because there would be no Toby if he would have taken the Christian hip hop route. You know what I'm saying? What I would love is to see more churches, more institutions that are Christian, to give people the space to say, go and thrive. And we're going to send our people. We're going to support you in a way that doesn't have First Ebenezer Baptist Church are tied to it, right? So therefore you limit the audience, right? You limit the things you feel like you have to talk about. Like, how do you remove that evangelical edit away from the artists that are creating, but still love them? You know what I'm saying? And I think that's what I would encourage churches to do. I mean, there's obviously other things theologically, but yeah.
That's rich. That's really, really good. Absolutely. They should be supporting this work, because it's kingdom work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, my friend.
Wow. Well, Shaw, man, you gave us so much to think about. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm glad we had this conversation. I think it was healing for us.
Yes.
And important.
And visionary. I feel like there's going to be more stuff that comes out of this. We're going to be texting right after this.
All right. Yes. Throw me in and hit me up. Let me know what's up.
Exactly. Well, where can people support what you're doing? You're doing so much that I want to give you space to talk about, you know, your creative routes and where people can support and give money, and obviously buy the book, you know, bookstores, but what else is going on?
Well, the book obviously is taking a lot of time. The other thing that I plan on doing is I have this venture called One Good Night. And so we're going to do a virtual event on July 31st, and it's going to be donation based. And so it's basically where all my talents and my friends' talents come together. So it's short films, comedy sketches, rants, monologues, and a musical performance. And it'll be virtual. But then after that, I plan on taking it on the road and doing live events across the country. So like, instead of it being like a full blown musical tour, it's like a one man show, if you will. And that'll be in the fall. And so that's one way that people could support. That'll happen on July, like I said, July 31st. You can follow me on social media platforms at Amisho Baraka. It's my full name, AmishoBaraka. And yep.
No, that's awesome.
There we go. Hollow Show. Good. At one good night.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, the website will do that info. We'll be happy to share it. Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, bro. Absolutely. No, for real though. Thank you guys for having me on, man. Thank you for the conversation. And we rescheduled like 3 times, but God bless. I do think this conversation is my hope is this, is that this conversation will expand to the brothers and sisters on the four corners of the Black Christian space, because there are some tough conversations that needs to happen, and
yes,
hopefully they can happen in a space of hospitality, or people can walk away and not just talk about the stuff, but do the stuff, if you will.
Amen. Thank you, Shaw.
Thank you, brother.
Y'all be good.